Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. You know the drill. So today I'm going to be talking about a novel by a first-time novelist. I don't normally go for a first-time novelist. Lots of people send me stuff saying, hey, I'm a new novelist, can you review my book? And I say no. And even lots of established authors and, you know, publishers always send me stuff, and I generally turn it down. I like to choose what I read and review myself, rather, and also going by recommendations from SFBRP listeners who know me, rather than just going by what publishers and authors want me to read and review, as though I'm some kind of publicity machine for them. Sometimes I will read an unsigned author, like a self-published author, because a lot of these stories do come out, and if enough people say, hey, this is actually a really good novel, or this is a good short story, or this is a good collection. For example, like Hugh Howey, it's quite famously self-published his Wool series, and I read the Wool Omnibus and really, really enjoyed it. So I thought, well, I can always give it a go with some of these authors. This author is, actually, I'm a big fan of his work. He is a web comic artist and writer, webcomicker. I'm not even sure what the word is, the job title is, but he makes a webcomic called Basic Instructions, Scott Meyer from Basic Instructions. And often these webcomics, they only have like one gag at the end of the comic or the little strip after like a few panels, or maybe there's just one panel with one joke. Thing is with Basic Instructions that I like so much is that every panel, there's always four panels, and every panel has a joke, which is normally about as funny as any one single comic strip, or the full comic strip by another artist. So I thought, in my continuing theme of finding funny people that I like on the internet, for example, Yahtzee Croshaw, I reviewed his novel Mogworld. I thought, well, Scott Meyer, also a funny guy, makes me laugh a lot. How about reading a novel by the same writer? But, you know, what could go wrong? A month ago, Scott Meyer, on his comic strip, I get them by the RSS feed, and it came through and he says, oh, I've written a novel. It's, it's like a science fiction fantasy kind of thing. Check it out. And I was like, okay, I will. So I downloaded it, partly to read it. You know, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to read it or not. But, you know, also, like, I like supporting people who I'm fans of on the internet by, you know, if they put something else, I'll buy it. I'll buy a book. I'll give a donation if they ask for it, you know, just to help support artists that I enjoy. So this novel is called Off to Be the Wizard. And let me bring up, I have the Goodreads page for it here. It says it's 276 pages, published 29th of March, 2013, yeah, so that's like the end of March. Now it's the very beginning of May, 1st of May here, yeah, so about a month this book has been out. And the blurb is, it's a simple story. Boy finds proof that reality is a computer program. Boy uses program to manipulate time and space. Boy gets into trouble. Boy flees back to medieval England to live as a wizard while he tries to think of a way to fix things. Boy gets in more trouble. Oh, and boy meets girl at some point. So that's pretty much the setup. Again, that's not really any spoilers there. It's right there in the blurb, and all of that happens in the first, about the first 20% of the novel. So yeah, it starts off, as it says here, the boy is called Martin Banks, and he's just a guy at home, and he discovers something world-shattering. That's the first opening paragraph of the novel. It says, when you find out something world-shattering, what does it feel like? And of course, he's found out this, that we all kind of live in the Matrix. We all live in a computer program. He finds this text file, and this text file is kind of, I think it's either meant to be his life or like the thing that is controlling all of it. It's a 5 terabyte file, and he doesn't download it, but he does. He can access it via some kind of online scripting, bash script prompt thing. I'm not entirely sure, but he gets into it and he starts searching through this 5 terabyte file. And of course, it takes a long time to do all that kind of stuff. And he realizes that he finds his own name in there, and he realizes that by changing information that's in his part of this massive text file, It's like he actually changes reality. Dun 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 dun. So what does he do with this power? He's like, oh, I can do anything with this power. I can do this. There's actually a few little bits of fun time travel stuff where he meets himself from 20 seconds in the future, which is quite fun. And then he's like, okay, I am a nerd. I work in a cubicle at work, and I come home and I do this. What is the, you know, kind of like nerd geek cubicle worker wish fulfillment? So he's like, yes, I will do this, and I'll put more money in my bank account, and I will get a new car, and I will get myself a new apartment, and I will do this kind of stuff, but I won't do anything too bad. I'll just lie low. I'll keep my job at work, you know. And there's this weird, there's this quite clever little take on this where he goes, right, I can buy anything I want. So I'm going to IKEA to buy some nice IKEA furniture for my apartment, and I'm going to build that. And you're like, really, that's what you want to do? But I guess, yeah, if you don't want to make a big impact, like most people think, oh well, I'm happy with my life at the moment, you know, I have a, you know, I'd like a better job. But what would you do if you suddenly had all the money in the world and you could do whatever you want and you got unlimited power? What would you do? And so many people go, oh well, you know, I just carry on like I am, really. Yeah, I probably wouldn't give up my job. And what I like about this is that it's a guy who has of course always thought that, oh yeah, my life is pretty good, you know, I do what I want, I spend enough time, you know, as long as I've got a bit of space for myself and an internet connection and I can hang out with, you know, who I want to, probably just kind of just go along doing the same kind of thing. And of course, after about a chapter of that, he's like, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to do whatever I want. And then, of course, he gets into trouble. Yeah, when he starts doing whatever he wants, he gets into trouble. He gets chased by the cops, but in his phone, because he makes a way to access this file via his, I think, Android mobile phone, his smartphone. He has like this one button escape hatch, so when he needs to get out, he can press this, and this will take him to, it'll take him away from the modern world. He can't go forward in time past the time that he's already experienced. He can only go back in time. So he goes, well, what's the nicest time? I'll go back to medieval England, because medieval England, you know, people will speak English, I guess, and I'll be able to get by, and I'll have all these special powers, and people will think I'm a wizard, but they won't think I'm a wizard who has to be killed, because medieval England, you can get by being a real wizard. And so he goes back in time, and this happens, you know, in the first... I get checked, it's like the first 15% of the novel all this happened, so it's not so much a big spoiler here, but he goes back in time, and I thought, oh right, it's going to be like Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, except instead of the Yankee just kind of seeming magical due to his knowledge, like his future technology knowledge, and, you know, knowing future weapons technology and knowing how to build this and knowing how to build that from the late 19th century or whenever that novel was written, this time the Connecticut Yankee goes back in time to medieval England and is actually a wizard. He can control time and space, and he can control, you know, he can go backwards and forwards, and instead of just building stuff in the past, he can go forward in time again and pick something up from the future and then take it back to the past. So massive plot holes aside, it was never really explained what his mobile phone was connected to while he was in medieval England. It just sort of says, oh yes, he adjusted the file. Like, if you can adjust time and space and reality to the point where you can, a mobile phone can still get a signal and connect to this file back in medieval England, fair enough, I'll just go with it. He goes back in time, and I was like, this is great. He has to prove that he's a wizard, and what he does, he goes, look at this plastic bag. Ooh, plastic bag. And they're like, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. Can you get more of that stuff? And he's like, yep, no problem. So then he pops back in time, and he goes to his parents' house and picks up some more plastic bags and cling film and comes back and goes, hey, check it out. So it's all really good up until that point. Up until the end of this certain chapter, 20% of the way into the novel, I was having a lot of fun. And then it all just goes to shit, because he meets another wizard, and then he meets more than one other wizard. And then it's like, oh, so it, just imagine like Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. He goes back in time, and when he goes back in time, he discovers that there's like 20 other people from the 20th century, on the 19th or 20th century, are already there. And they've already sorted out the society, so he doesn't need to do any changes to the political nature or do anything like that. They've already introduced all the new technology that they want from the future, you know, all the 20th century things like, you know, washing hands when you do surgery and all these other things that make everyone's lives better. Someone's already done all of that. They've already discovered all of the rules for, you know, working with this 5 terabyte reality file, and they've scripted all this kind of stuff, and then Martin turns up, like our Yankee turns up in King Arthur's court, and it's like there's nothing for him to do because it's all been accomplished. Everything worth doing has already been accomplished. So before, like up until 20% of the way into this novel, after Beard the Wizard, like Martin has been doing something new. He's been discovering new things. He's taking a journey that nobody's ever done before. Or at least so I thought. And then as soon as you cross that 20% mark, you realize, oh, Martin is just following other people. Instead of discovering things for himself, everything that he needs to know is just being handed to him. And it's unsatisfying when that happens. Like, it's unsatisfying if you're just reading a story where somebody is just following along from what other people have done. You know, someone has already done all the investigation, and instead of you finding stuff out, it's just handed to you on a plate. It's just boring. And yes, and the worst thing is that all of the cool stuff that he's done up until then, you thought he was clever doing that. Well, you didn't think he was clever because he was a bit of a stupid, but you thought, oh, he's learning this. And then just imagine learning all that kind of stuff and then someone turning around and saying, ah, yeah, we've already done all of that. You don't need to worry about that. We've already made all the mistakes. Hey, learn from all the mistakes that we've already made, but we're not going to show you this in this book. You'll just have to believe us and just take away. And I was just like, it's boring, really boring. And then he starts wizard training from people who've already gone through all of that stuff and learned it all themselves. And it's just boring. And it takes ages. The story just stops. There's no drama. There's no tension. There's nothing at all for Martin to learn, you know, except for stuff that's already been learned and he's just repeating it. And the stuff that he does learn new, we don't get to find out until later because he's like, oh, yes, and I'm keeping this a secret until my initiation into the wizard ceremony. So all the stuff that he does work out, we don't see the later until we just see, like, the results of it. And all of the stuff that he's learning isn't to accomplish anything except for the nerd wish fulfillment thing, which is just, I want to make my life nicer, and for the people around me, I want it to be nice for them as well. And everything's just about niceness. And there's some little hints that something else is going on, something a little bit more, you know, sinister. But really, it's just like, oh, I want to make life nice for me. I want a nice thing here, and this is going to be nice for me. And you're just like, I don't want the stuff to be nice. The reason he went back to medieval England, and this is actually a really clever point. It's like the whole idea of like, oh, I'm cursed to live in interesting times. It's like, well, you don't want to live in interesting times. What's the one time that you can live in where things aren't interesting, things are comfortable and nice? Well, this medieval England, you know, there's no plagues yet. The Crusades are elsewhere. There's political stability because after the Normans came in and, you know, all that kind of stuff that they're actually wanting. It's like, oh, what's the nicest, easiest place to live in medieval? Well, let's go there. But the point is, the nicest things are the most boring things. If all you're doing is trying to make things, you've already got a nice life and you're learning all of this stuff just to make things nicer. Boring. So it's like the Matrix. So Neo comes out of the Matrix and others are ahead of him. Yeah. So it's no problem that Morpheus is already there and Trinity is already there. They've already gone through this same journey. Not a problem. Because when Neo goes through his training, like, the movie, The Matrix, opens with Trinity kicking ass. You know what this training is going to be used for. Like, he's going to be fighting stuff. He has to go back into The Matrix. And, you know, his training is so that he can do missions within The Matrix. And then he's going to run away from the agents. And we see the agents doing stuff. We see Agent Smith kicking ass as well and being a badass. And Zion needs saving. And you know, and in the real world, they've got the hovercraft, the Nebuchadnezzar, and it's flying around. And there's robots chasing it. It's got to defend itself by like the EMPs and all of this cool stuff that's going on. And within all of this cool stuff, within all of this drama, within all of this like conflict and tension and stress, Neo is training, and he's training, you know, with his kung fu, and he's learning how to go through the Matrix and read the green stuff, you know, the green characters falling down. It's going all, it's all awesome. Or the other thing to think about, you know, is like when if a hero goes on a journey, you think about Star Wars, you know, it's like Luke is learning how to control the Force, okay, and he does this and he controls this and he's got these extra powers. And you know, in Star Wars, the first movie, there's not really, you know, the Force isn't well explained, but you know, just like, who doesn't want to become a, you know, a Jedi? Well, of course everyone would like to become a Jedi, but Luke is kind of like, His parents, well, not his parents, his aunt and uncle have just been killed by the Empire, and he wants to strike back at the Empire, and you know, and and all this other, he wants to follow in his father's footsteps and become a Jedi. There's many reasons why he goes through the training, and the training is over pretty quickly. You know, it's only a minor part of the story. And in The Matrix, the training is over pretty quickly. It's a minor part. But of course, like, well, who wouldn't want to become a Jedi? No, but you've got to have something worth fighting for. And who wouldn't want to become an awesome kick-ass guy? You know, like, Neo is like the most awesome guy. He turns out to be the most awesome guy, but like, he needs to become the most awesome guy for a reason. And in Off to Be the Wizard, from 20% of the novel, like, there is no conflict, there is no tension. Martin just starts learning stuff for no reason at all, except to make his life slightly nicer, just to have a nice world. And it's just boring. Like, just reading, just going, well, of course, who wouldn't want to make their life nicer? But, like, if that's the only thing driving someone in, it's like, well, who wouldn't? Hey, do you want $1 million? Yeah, of course. Well, who wouldn't want $1 million? Well, what if this $1 million, like, someone had to die to give you this $1 million? Okay, well, maybe not. Well, if you need this $1 million, you've got to give up all of this other stuff. Ah, okay, if you want this million, if it's just like, you want $1 million? Yeah, what's the catch? No catch. What have I got to give up? Nothing. What kind of conflict is introduced there? Nothing. You just get $1 million. Oh, that's great. Well, I'll get it, and I'll give part of it away to charity, and I'll spend some of this stuff on myself, and I'll buy my girlfriend something nice. You know, it's all those kind of things that you just go, oh, wow, yeah, $1 million. Thanks a lot. But you don't see all of the other stuff going on too. So I just checked up again. The story picks up once Martin has actually become a wizard again, and then suddenly something that's it, there's a few little sinister things that have been hinted at comes back in, and then the story picks up again at the 72% mark. So that's from 20% of the way through the novel to 72% of the way through the novel, nothing is happening except a guy is training to make his life nicer. 50% of the book I was totally bored. And then when the story picks up again, I'm actually like, oh, this is interesting. And the story picks up and all the stuff that he's learned so far comes into his own and all that kind of stuff. But by then, Martin isn't anyone special anymore. He's just another one of 20 or so wizards who also went back to the nicest point in history for English speaking people, which is medieval England. And they've all got the same powers and they've all got the same skills. They've all gone through that same journey. Excuse me, I just need a drink. They've all had exactly the same journey as Martin has. It's just he was the 20th person to go through it. And then when the action kicks off, nothing about him is really special, except that he, you know, he's got his gang, you know, his, what do you call it? The Galaxy S3, Samsung Galaxy S3. You know, he's got his mobile phone with him, which is connected to the internet. So, you know, he gets a little bit of an advantage then. And yeah, it's just like, well, make that journey something special, or at least make it interesting that he's got something to fight for, or you know what the training is going to be. You know, like even in Harry Potter, when he goes through his training school, there's always, you know, there's Snape and Voldemort and all these other guys, you know, this other stuff, there's darkness there. And when he goes through his training, all these other adventures are happening while he's going through Hogwarts, like 7 books worth of adventures goes through before he actually becomes a real wizard. Don't go, oh, and then he becomes a real wizard. And if you do that, make it not 50% of the book, like Wizard of Earthsea. You know, get the training out of the way pretty quickly and skip over as much of it as possible and then get onto the main story. Don't make the training the majority of the book. And finally, when it comes to the... Well, not finally, maybe there's more, but in my notes here. The next massive problem with the story is that it's a time travel story, but time travel is too easy. And if time travel is too easy, everything can be solved by going back in time and making things right. Like, why wouldn't you just go back in time the previous day and say, hey, when you get to this point tomorrow, look behind you. And you're like, why? Just look back this time tomorrow. Just look behind you. Just, like... The whole Bill and Ted thing, when they go, oh, well, is it Bill and Ted's where they go, oh, well, all we need to do is that in the future when we get out of this problem, we'll hide a gun behind this cabinet. Yes, and here's the gun behind, we'll hide the key on this, or we'll put the key on this mantelpiece. Oh, look, here's the key, you know, and that kind of stuff. It, you know, that can be done for comedy effect, and it gets, and that then becomes the plot, that device then becomes the idea that you use. But the way to make a time travel story interesting is to make time travel hard. Either make it so you can only go back in time once and then you're stuck there, or, you know, it would make it really dangerous. Maybe you've got to drive a car really fast and then hit a wire at the exact moment that the lightning strikes, and Oh, you know, you can only go back in time to a single date or to a single spot, or make it so you can only go forward in times. So you can't go back to fix mistakes, or you can only go back to a place where you've never been before. You don't exist there. So you have to leave messages, and you're not quite sure if you're going to pick up the message, or maybe you go back in time to a place where it's impossible for you to affect the outcome of anything else. You know, there's all of these different ways to make time travel interesting. But, you know, it's sort of like, if everything is as easy to, you know, is time travel is as easy as it is for the wizards in this book, is like, why is anything a problem? Why is anything happening at all? Why is there any conflict? They could just be going, oh, as soon as this happens, I'll go back in time to a minute ago and say, hey, look behind you. That's really, like, all of the problems could have been solved just by doing that. And we know it's possible for these two. So you really, if you're doing a book like this, you've got to make it harder. Instead of just going, oh, I'll just press this button and go back in time. Make it so, like, okay, time travel is really, really dangerous. Even though we can just edit this file and transport ourselves to a different thing, we've got to copy and paste. But the information is constantly copying and pasting. And, you know, trying to do a text selection and stuff is moving. Or you're trying to click something, you know, in a menu and something's really moving around. And if you click the wrong place, you know, someone else will be deleted from the file and will just never exist, and they'll be chopped out of all our memories. You know, make it so it's difficult to do all of that. Anyway, yes. So my next note is the setting. So last year I went to Kansas City. I went to the Juggling Festival there, and last September, I guess it was September, October. Yeah, September. And a few people were like, "Hey, what we should do is go out to a Ren Fair." And I was like, "Oh, Ren Fair! I've never been to one of those before. You know, I've been to some like medieval reenactment kind of things in the UK, but you know, like the big American Ren Fair." And there were some jugglers. I was over there for a juggling festival, and there were some jugglers performing there. We could go and get in for free, and we'd see some of these, you know, local performers doing their things. And I was like, "Yeah, good, let's go for it." And so we walked around, and it was like, you know, of course Americans know what it's like, but it's lots of people dressed up in costumes and people putting on shows and lots of stalls where you can buy jewelry and handcraft stuff. And there was people riding around on horses, and I think there was elephants as well there. You know, it's quite a big deal, or it seemed like quite a big deal. And I was walking around, and then we were sitting, and after finishing up a show, there was me, and there was this other English guy who was traveling around America as well, and he was with us, another juggler. And the Americans were like saying, "Hey," one guy said, "Oh, hey, is this like being back at home in England?" And I pretty much said, "This is the single most American experience I've ever had." And the other English guy who was with me, he agreed totally, and we both went on to actually explain, like, this, like, the view of medieval England, ye olde England, with knights and wenches and all of these page boys and bards and all that kind of stuff, the view that these people have of that is purely influenced by like 1970s, 1980s movies. Well, probably later than that. You know, like it's their version. It's like the local Kansas City version of Hollywood's version of Victorian England's version of medieval England. So in other words, it never existed. Nothing there is even remotely historical true. And all of the research that is done by the people who are wanting to dress up as knights, all they do is look at movies. And the movies looked at drawings in, you know, in your Victorian retellings of King Arthur. And, you know, it's just all of it is just many, many layers away from actual history. And when you actually go to a medieval reenactment kind of thing in the UK, for a start, they normally take place in historical, like real historical places, in buildings which are older than United States, you know, buildings that go back 1,000 years or so, at least to the time of the Norman conquest of the of England and that kind of stuff. So it's just like the whole thing, like there is almost zero connection between like your medieval reenactment societies in the UK compared to the Ren Fairs in America. And I'm sure there are much more historically rigorous reenactment groups and things like that in the United States. But it was one of those things. Now, what has it got to do with this novel, Off to Be the Wizard? Because this feels very much like, you know, like modern day Ren Fair view of medieval England, rather than anything that could possibly even, you know, even it's even possible, you know, like if you're going to learn anything from you know, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, at least that you understand that the princess, she speaks this weird proto-German and not like modern English, and everyone is actually difficult to understand, and there's like the mindset difference. But we never really meet anybody from, like, there's only one or two people that we ever meet who are from medieval England, and the whole place is just a bit too, I would say, nice. I don't think, you know, if everything exists within a computer, you know, it's what you could say, like, as an apologist for this novel. It's like, well, it's all in a computer. It can be anything that you want. But it's just like, yeah, but it doesn't really have any bite to it. It doesn't have any, like, anything new to say. It doesn't have anything to say about medieval England at all, except, like, oh, and there's an inn. And what was the inn like? Oh, well, there was candles in the inn. And they went to this castle, and there was a castle. But this castle is a magical castle, so it never, ever felt like anything was happening in medieval England at all. It just felt like they'd gone to a theme park somewhere. You know, and they're just like this disconnect for comedy reasons. Like, oh, and these people, they were fine with being slim because they looked more beautiful. But in medieval times, isn't like slim, doesn't that mean ill? You need to be putting on weight and storing weight. You know, there's just all these disconnects between what I'm used to about medieval England, even just from other novels and other fantasy novels. There was just, you know, it was a bit, just a bit nice, but not nice in a way which was, you know, oh, it's pleasant and to do this. Oh, and you know, I can't remember what the book that I read, another time travel book. I think it was Michael Crichton's Timeline, and they go back in time to medieval England. It's like, yeah, everything's meant to be dirty. And it's like, actually, no, in medieval France, they had a cleanliness fetish and they were bathing every day and everything was actually trying to be nice and they were making everything smell nice. And you just go, oh, that's interesting. But it kind of brought to life medieval France via the cleanliness rather than just going, oh, no, everything's actually quite clean. Moving on to what have I got here? I need another drink. My voice is a little bit rough. I had to do three shows last night. I normally do two shows a night, but I had to do three 40-minute shows by myself. My voice is a little bit rough. Anyway, characters. Yeah, starting off with Martin. He begins quite interesting because we see him, like I said, this first 20% of the book, he's learning stuff on his own. He's making mistakes, and then we see him grow by making, like, after he makes mistakes. And then once these other characters turn up, these other wizards turn up, like, his main way of developing his character disappears, and he just becomes boring. And then all the other characters, you get Jimmy, who is this actually quite an interesting, well, I say an interesting villain. His motivations of being, I'd say, well, he's not even really a villain, you know, you're never even sure if he is a villain or not, but we're being told all the way through, this guy is the bad guy, this guy is the villain, because this guy over here called Philip, he was the nice guy who we're meant to like because he's nice, he really hates the guy over here because Jimmy is the villain, because Jimmy sets himself up as Merlin, and Jimmy controls too much, and he takes over London, and you just go, well, okay, he's just got a different view, a different approach, and he's a bit more forward, you know, he's less kind of, you know, shy, well, it wasn't much shy, he's less introverted about his geekiness, and he's like, no, I'm just going to do this. But all of the, we never really see him doing anything bad, we just see this other character telling our main character that this guy is bad. And then you get the, what else have I got here? Yeah, the other wizards, all totally interchangeable. I don't remember anything about them. They've got some, they wear different costumes and they live in different parts of Europe and they're from slightly different times. Some of them are from the 80s, some of them from the 90s, some of them from, like, you know, more up to date times and stuff. But they don't really contribute anything to this story except for people to hang around with. I really don't remember who does what later on. They have different names, but all they have are different names. And some of them actually, though, there's these two guys who go, oh, we like death metal. So, and because we like death metal, we went to live in Norway or Sweden or whatever it is, and we do this stuff. And he goes, death metal wizards, and they have an urge to fulfill stereotypes because they put horns on their helmets and wear bat wings and stuff. And it's like, you know, don't tell me that these characters just have an urge to fulfill stereotypes. At least I remember what they look like. Everyone else just, like, wears these wizard robes, and it's like that. So you've got 20 wizards running around, and at this point you kind of have, like, zero, like, economy of characters. Like, how many characters do you need to tell this story? Okay, each one of these characters has to fulfill a role, otherwise they're superfluous and they're not needed. But we have, like, 18 of these 20 wizards. Actually, I don't even remember how many wizards there are, but there's numerous wizards, and you're just like, well, all but four of them we don't really need for this story, and yet so often they're just hanging around. And then there's this other character, Gwen, who is the girl that the boy meets, as talked about in the blurb. and she doesn't seem to have any reason to exist as a main character, and then suddenly at one point she becomes like the catalyst for resuming the plot, you know, about at about like this 72% of the way through this novel when the plot actually picks up again, and she's kind of a solution to the plot, and she's got a main revelation to the plot, which is, again, you could see coming a mile off, and which also brings up massive plot holes. You're like, well, this can't be right, she can't do this, because then there'd be this massive plot hole, and then she doesn't, oh, okay. And then suddenly there's, like, too much economy of characters, because there's, like, these three different roles which could have been fulfilled in the story by three different characters are all sort of jammed into one character. What else have I got here? Oh, yeah, turned on. Yeah, there's this Martin when he meets Gwen, you know, Gwen's beautiful and all that kind of stuff. And then she does something clever and it's like, oh, and I was so turned on by the cleverness. And it's just like, and for me, I really dislike this. This is a real sign of, like, of a writer who does, I mean, I don't want to blame it at first novel and everything like that, but you just go, well, is this all that you need? Like, all you need is a good looking woman who also displays intelligence, and that's a turn on. Is that a turn on? If so, why isn't a guy who is intelligent, is that a turn on as well? Is it is it like intelligence accompanied by boobs? Is that all it needs to be turned on? And yeah, it's just a bit of one of those weird moments where you just go, oh, nothing here was like, why are you conflating these things? Anyway, it was just a minor issue. A good author could have done that well, but it just felt a little bit creepy at that point for me. Moving on to the writing, I expected comedy because I wanted to laugh. Scott Mayer is very, very funny. I really enjoy his comics. He has his whole series. There's a whole the Rocket Hat storyline where he's got all these superheroes going around, and there's time travel, there's Omnipresent Man, there's loads of really great ideas and really funny stuff in Basic Instructions, the webcomic. Unfortunately, Off to Be the Wizard, I didn't find it very funny. There were some good lines, and there's this very funny line about making a tent, and there's these, a few of the lines about which made me laugh a lot. However, real comedy depends on kind of conflict. It depends on differing viewpoints. Basic Instructions, the webcomic, works really well, mainly due to the fact that one person has one point of view and the other person standing on the other side of that same panel has a different point of view. And those two points of views are very clear to us, the reader. And then one of the characters understands that the view of the other person is different from theirs, and they comment on it even as the other person remains oblivious that the two people's views are different. And the funniest comics are when both characters, either side, both realize that the points of view of the person standing at the other side of the panel is different from their own, and yet they carry on commenting about it as though the other... Yeah, it's just one of those weird things. It's like, well, of course I'm right, and I'm going to say all this stuff because I'm right. And the other person over the side is like, well, of course I'm right, and I'm going to say all this other stuff that because I'm... Of course I'm right. And we as the readers look at the person standing on the right of the panel, and we're like, yes, of course you're right. And this other person, of course they're wrong, but that difference in opinions, that difference in viewpoints, and that you're both commenting on it is what makes it very funny. In Off to Be the Wizard, for a long time at the beginning, Martin is working by himself, so we don't have these two conflicting viewpoints. We don't have any of this chance for comedy, which Scott Mayer writes so well in his webcomic. Then sometimes if something happens and he meets a co-worker, and I'm like, oh, this is great. This is the kind of stuff that we know from Basic Instructions. A lot of the time he spends at work and he's talking with his co-workers that he doesn't like and co-workers that he does like, and the boss character with the mullet and then the client of the guy who works for, you know, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, Martin doesn't, he goes to work and then like leaves pretty quickly, and that doesn't happen. And the agents turn up, and these special agents are pretty funny as well. And then when he gets to medieval England, that comedy reaches a peak in a way, because he has the view that I am a wizard, and all of the other people in Old English are going, this guy isn't a wizard, he's just a joker, you know. And he's putting on an act, and then he's trying not to spoil his act, and all those things, and that's quite funny. There's some funny stuff there. And then at that 20% of the novel point, when Martin meets up with those wizards and he starts his training, suddenly he's the least clever person in the story rather than the most clever in the story. And then none of the lines are funny because, like, the other characters, I'm not saying they're making jokes at his expense, but nothing really feels personable. And the situations that he gets into just aren't funny situations. And the poop jokes aren't really funny. They're just kind of this painfully obvious, like, oh, I'm going to telegraph this thing that's going to come in really handy at the end. You're like, oh, of course that's going to come in. And And then they'll grab hold of a staff or a wand, and someone will say, "When you grab your staff, don't say the obvious joke." And you're like, "Well, okay, say don't say the obvious joke. That's kind of a funny line when you talk about that, because it's obviously going to be a dick joke. Don't do a grab your staff dick joke." But then, it, like 5 or 6 times later, they're saying, "Take your wand, but don't say the obvious joke." It's just like, well, what is the obvious joke? If it's so obvious, wouldn't it be funny that, like, after all that time, the obvious joke was different for everyone? Like, the obvious joke for one person was this joke, and the obvious joke for this other person is here. And then someone goes, "Oh, I thought the obvious joke was this." And the other guy goes, "Well, all this time, I thought this was the obvious joke. Oh, no, this is the obvious joke." But the whole obvious joke is never revealed to be a joke at all. And again, there's no conflict. There's no two different people thinking different things and that revelation of two different things. What else have I got here? Yeah, tonally, like, they're in a really bad situation at one point, and Martin has this funny thought. He's like, "Oh, blah, 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 blah." And it's quite amusing. He goes, "He considered sharing this idea with the other wizards, but he knew nobody, not even him, was in the mood." And he's just like, no, we're not in the mood at this point. It should be dangerous. It should be scary. And then we take a diversion into a joke. And it's just like, well, why didn't we have these jokes earlier on when it was all light and fluffy and you're actually wanting to, you know, to make it nice? But again, the idea that, like, nobody else was in the mood and yet he's having these funny observations, that makes comedy. That's actually what made it funny, that he was in one situation and he was having inappropriate thoughts. But for 52% of this book, there is no inappropriate situation. There is no differing things. The only thing, like, that's going on is that Philip is going, "Hey, this guy over here, he's bad." And this other bad guy over there is going, "I'm not that bad. Stop hating me." And there's just not enough there, because either the guy is obviously bad or he's not bad. And then Philip is just being a dick. So it's difficult to do. Another mistake. Oh, yeah, don't bring up bad novels if you are writing a novel which you don't know for sure is an awesome novel. One character goes, "I must be hiding some blah, blah, blah. Because of this, I must be hiding some sinister secret, like we're nothing but two-dimensional characters in a bad novel." That's dangerous territory to bring up. Don't bring up that the fact that this character might be a two-dimensional character in a bad novel unless you're sure that that character isn't a one-dimensional character in a terrible novel. Something like that. Oh, yeah, and one of the main themes later on, or one of the main things that I talk about, is, like, there's more to innovation than just putting together... there's more to innovation than just putting other people's ideas together like Lego bricks. Again, it made sense within the novel. However, you've got to be really careful with this, because this book is like The Matrix plus Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, plus generic wizard school material, you know, like Harry Potter or Earthsea or something like that. Some of the situations are mildly original, but then the entire book is just like straining under the weight of very many similar stories and many ideas told far better in the past or even in the recent past. More errors. Yeah, viewpoints, sometimes a bit rough. You're never quite sure. It's like, well, why are you suddenly following this person over here? Why are we seeing it from their point of view? I thought we were seeing it from Martin's point of view. There's some errors in writing, like spelling and punctuation, but it's an ebook, though. Those can easily be fixed. I even sent an email to Scott Mayer picking out most of the errors that I saw. Oh, yeah, and also there's some nerd references, because some characters come from the 80s and some characters come from the 90s. There's actually quite a nice little playfulness going that some of them, you know, have only ever used their Commodore 64s and other of them have used, you know, bigger and better computers like that. But then you get these references, like some of them do a teleport and it describes the teleport in quite a lot of detail, saying, oh, it's a blue fuzzy thing and then it came down, the shimmering things. I was like, oh, so they're doing like the Star Trek, you know, beam me up, Scotty reference. And then they go, oh, one of the characters goes, oh, was that the Star Trek reference? And the other one's like, yes, that is a Star Trek reference. I'm like, why did you give that away? And then there's a Ghostbusters reference, which I didn't catch straight away, but he goes, that was a Ghostbusters reference. Yes, it was. You're like, well, okay. Like, now I feel stupid because I didn't get the Ghostbusters reference, and then you explain to me that I should have got that. Oh, and there's a Konami code as well, and it's like, da-da-da-da, and this word, and it's like, oh, isn't that the Konami code? Yes, it means up, up, down, down, no, up, down, whatever. I don't even know the Konami code, but I recognize it when I see it. Like, I watched Wreck-It Ralph a few weeks ago and really enjoyed that, and at one point did the Konami code, and I was like, oh, that's the Konami code. You don't need, like, when you bring up clever references, then telling us that you've brought up a clever reference makes us either feel more stupid because we didn't get the reference, or it makes us feel patronized that you're telling us that we did get the reference. Finally, what's the book about? Normally I talk about themes and things that this made, like, after all of the technical writing stuff, what did the book make me think about? Like, what did it remind me of? All those different kind of things. What are the themes of the book? And it's a bit strange because I read Mogworld by Yahtzee Croshaw, and that's a book, you know, about everyone is code running on a computer, and that made me think about issues in a new way, because it was kind of self-consistent and everything made sense, even though it was a bit, some of it was a bit clunky in some ways, but like, there was these scenes that are written which made me go, oh, well, what is humanity? What is, you know, life? What is free will? What is all these different things, you know, all these ethics about people living in computers? And when we get to this book, Off to Be the Wizard, and it just kind of, like, every time something, an issue like that, it kind of made me go, oh, don't think about it too hard, because as soon as an issue comes up, I'd think about it, and then there's, like, this massive plot inconsistencies or character inconsistencies, and the only conclusion that you get in the end is, like, well, maybe the evil force in this book is actually right, maybe that is the correct way to look at it. Another thing that I thought about is the whole idea of the wish fulfillment fiction for geeks who work in cubicles, which is, again, like The Matrix. I mean, I didn't mention it so far, but the front cover of this novel, let me just bring it up here. I guess I can click here and go to the cover. Goes Off to Be the Wizard, even though it should be called Off to Be a Wizard, and by Scott Mayer. And the main image is a wizard's hat drawn from ASCII art, you know, made up of different characters, which are green characters, which, of course, you should go, oh, well, this is sort of like a, you know, this is the best you can do. Like, I had an Amstrad 464 and it only had a green screen monitor. So, you know, I understand what's going on here, but you can't look at that and say, this is not The Matrix. And then you think, well, The Matrix, what was that? That was also wish fulfillment fiction for geeks who work in cubicles. In Matrix, you know, like I said before, Neo is a hacker, and then he turns out to be the most badass guy ever. He is Neo. He is the one. He is the prophesied one. And I think the main problem with that is that, well, I don't want to be violent. I don't want to defeat the bad guy by violence. I don't want to defeat the bad guy by thinking about, you know, about just by beating stuff up. And what do we need? Guns, more guns, you know? Oh, that was another thing that I wanted to say. Like, when Martin gets there, by the time he actually has to use his action, he's not the new guy anymore. He's now just one of the gang. And the good thing about Neo is that he kind of got into a situation that's like, wait, why didn't you run away from the agents? He's like, I didn't. Should I run away from the agents? Like, nobody's ever fought them before. Nobody's ever done that before. He's like, haven't they? Well, I'm new around here. This is just the way I do it. It's like, wow, nobody's ever done that before either. And he's like, really? Well, you know, I'm just getting on with it. I'm just doing the job the best I know how. And Martin is like, well, I know what everybody's done in the past. I've got full access to this. You know, everyone's done it this way before, and I'll just continue on. You know, there's nothing to do it. So anyway, like, but the whole point is that, like, Neo starts off working in a cubicle. He's a bit of a wimp. He doesn't like walking around the outside of buildings. He doesn't want to get in the car. You know, he's not sure what the blue pill, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, like, there's nothing like, oh, well, what's your geek fulfillment? Well, I'm going to go to IKEA and buy all this furniture I want and then build it, which is actually really sweet. I mean, I did that earlier this year. I bought a new dishwasher and installed a new kitchen, and IKEA seemed to be the best way to fit into my weird-shaped kitchen. And I built it. And you know what? Building IKEA furniture really sucks. But it's nice to think that there's people out there who are kind-hearted enough to go and actually think, well, my life, one of my main wishes in life is to buy IKEA furniture and to buy a car, which isn't too nice. You know, the whole idea of, like, oh, well, if I carried on with life, I just want it to be nice. You know, cursed to live in interesting times. Well, actually, I'll go and live in the coziest and easing time ever. And of course it's boring, but it's clever because it's boring. Like, if you're actually clever, if you're actually a real geek, you will do your research and you will find out the least stressful place to go and then go there. I think I've told a story before about, like, someone saying this, oh, like, the previous girlfriend was saying, well, you know, we were practicing me saving her in a situation when we're, like, on the edge of a cliff and she falls over and I'm grabbing her. We were practicing, like, in that situation where I have you, will I be able to pull you back up to the top of the cliff? It turns out, yes, in that situation, I did kind of, like, sprain my shoulder a bit, but I could one-armed pull my girlfriend up to the top of the cliff, and it started off the whole conversation. It's like, well, you know, I love you so much, I'd die for you. No, well, actually, I'd love you so much that I'd kill for you. And then it gets to the point, it's like, well, no, I love you so much that I would do everything impossible in my power to put us into situations where me dying for you or me having to kill for you or us dying together and all that kind of stuff is just off the table. That's never going to happen. I love you so much that I want the most comfortable, most boring life in terms of life-threatening situations to go for. And that's what this book is. And it's actually quite nice that all of the characters, all of the main characters are pretty nice guys. And they just want to get along, and they just want to do good stuff, and they want to be kind to people, and they don't want to do this, and they want to do that, and they just want to make life better for people. But it's just boring. It's like, you can do that. I mean, it would be possible to do that, and it could have happened. You know, I think there is a fun novel, or there could have been a fun novel in there, which is the 50% of the novel which I don't like, which is just, oh, you're in this situation and you've got to learn to live in this situation. But the conflict has to be then character based. It has to be interpersonally based. You know, it could just be like, you know, all of the hundreds of webcomics about out there, which are about, oh, I'm a webcomic, and this is my, you know, semi-autobiographical webcomic about me in going to work in my cubicle, and this is my comic about me going to college and not being there, and this is the one about living with my flatmates at home, and this is the one about me playing computer games. It's possible to do that, but it has to have some level of satire. It has to have some level of, like, speaking to true situations. And it could be there. There could be a novel there. Unfortunately, Off to Be a Wizard, really isn't that book at all. It tries to do so much more. It's like, oh, and instead of fighting like Neo does, we'll do stuff by using our brains and being intelligent. And then guess what happens at the end of the book? There's a big fight, which is like the big fight at the end of the third Matrix. Well, it's not really like that, but it's, you know, it's this big thing, showdown, and it's just like, yeah, well, after all of that of using brains, why did it have to be... Why was the solution then just violence in the end, when the whole thing was meant to be nice people being nice to each other? Although there is a nice twist at the end, which is pretty creepy and I quite liked. Anyway, that brings me to the end of the review. I've talked a lot about this. I'm going to give this book, I'd say, like, 1.5 stars, maybe 2 stars, maybe give it 2 stars, I guess, because there is, like, if it was like the first 20% of the book and the last 30% of the book and the middle, 50% or that 52% chunk in the middle, which is just him training, if that would shrunk down to 10% of the book, I would have got through it and actually really enjoyed this book. If this book was 40% shorter and the 40% that wasn't there was him just learning about stuff and getting on with other wizards in a really boring way, I think this would actually be a good book. So there is enough stuff in this book to not to recommend it by any means, but to give it at least 2 stars. And I guess it really just confirms that this is the reason why I don't like reading novels by first-time novelists, or reading stories by first-time novelists for the most part, is that, you know, I need somebody else to weed out these problems and to give them a few goes. Like, if he'd have written this book and then, like, written 2 other novels and then come back to it and given it another go in a few years' time, it would probably be, like, an awesome novel. But as far as it is, it's, you know, I just can't recommend it. So, anyway, that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening. You can comment on this review if you go to goodreads.com. Follow me there. I'm Luke Bowditch at Goodreads. There's 2 ways, of course, to chat about this. You can either just comment on my review, like other people comment on my reviews. There's normally people there. Or you can start a thread in the SFBRP listener group there on goodreads.com. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Bowditch on Twitter. I post stuff there, although I don't post there very much. That's mostly for me keeping up with other stuff. You can check out Scott Mayer's comic. Go to basicinstructions.net. He's a very funny comic, webcomic artist, and I do highly recommend that. What else? Yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. The next book that I review, I'm not quite sure. It could be Rendezvous with Rama, which I'll do with Juliana. And thanks a lot for all the feedback. People seem to be enjoying this the recent Solaris episode as well. Or I've got some other e-books and audiobooks that I'm going through at the moment. I'll just see which one I finish first and get around to doing the review of. Anyway, that's it from me. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.